Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Wednesday, June 3rd, 2015, with his signature on the extension of the Patriot Act. Barack Obama now owns the national surveillance state, lock, stock, and barrel.
I own it, content with my wrongness, heartbreaker, heartaker, content with my wrongness.
Despite his past posturing as a candidate and his history as a constitutional law instructor, Barack Obama has shown through his actions that his words, his rhetoric about the balance between privacy and security, his rhetoric about the value of the Bill of Rights and our constitutional protections under the Fourth Amendment, all those words are meaningless. Because this president used demagoguery and fear-mongery and stoked hysteria in order to preserve the powers under the Patriot Act that we have discussed in great detail here. The two provisions that have, we're told, never been used, the lone wolf provision and the roving wiretap provision. But he said we just have to have that power to keep Americans safe. And the telephone metadata program, it is slightly modified based on who holds the calling records. But our information is still up for grabs, and despite the passage of this bill, it actually reinstated the old program for 6 months while they transitioned to the new program. And this idea of Obama's ownership is not limited to my opinion. Michael Shear, writing in the New York Times under the News Analysis line, says that now, after successfully badgering Congress into reauthorizing the program with new safeguards the president says will protect privacy, he has left little question that he owns it. And I'm linking in the show file to this podcast to a powerful essay by Spencer Ackerman. He came over from Wired magazine. He has been at The Guardian for a year or two now. And he does great work, and I think he is an excellent observer of the scene. I want to quote extensively from his piece. He says, "The Snowden revelations began a process of classic Obama vacillation, bringing him from public defender of domestic mass surveillance to its reluctant and partial critic. It was a path crafted by politics, accelerated by law, and fueled by fear." And we're going to detail some of the fearful commentary here in just a moment. But Ackerman continues with a quote from Josh Earnest, the White House press secretary. "To the extent that we're talking about the president's legacy, I would suspect that that would be a logical conclusion from some historians, that the president ended some of these programs." So do you understand what's going on here? The president's actions are to preserve and expand the surveillance operations on Americans, innocent Americans, on a daily basis, while his press mouthpiece says that this is the president who reformed the surveillance programs. I mean, this is disingenuous bullshit. And it is served up by the corporate media, for the most part, without question. Without skepticism, without challenge. So Ackerman goes way back to July 2008 when the Democratic presidential nominee cast his Senate vote to expand the NSA's grasp, retroactively blessing the program that secretly collected our international communications in bulk. The bill that Obama voted for, and which, by the way, he had opposed as a candidate, it ultimately created the internet dragnet known as PRISM, and we know about that because of Ed Snowden's disclosures. Ackerman continues, "Once in power, Obama embraced domestic bulk data collection, even as the NSA's massive appetite for phone records was in secret legal peril. A judge on the typically pliant Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, or FISA, was so incensed that the NSA's software for querying U.S. phone records went beyond the technological boundaries described to the panel that he effectively shut down NSA access for much of 2009. yet Obama continued the program. Similarly, Obama permitted the NSA to gather Americans' internet records in bulk until 2011, and only disclosed that he shut the program down in response to Snowden's revelations. It remains unclear why Obama ended it, but a recent Justice Department report makes clear that the FBI has for years been amassing large collections of the same data. And of course, none of that is touched by any of the activity in Washington. It's not even talked about. And there is very little comment on day two of the revelation of the FBI's fleet of more than 100 Cessnas equipped with high-def video gear. And we are told in at least some cases the dirt boxes that scoop up all of the cell phone data within its range. Nope, none of that is being touched. It's not even being talked about. Returning to Ackerman's commentary here. He says that Obama set up his own advisory body, heavy with intelligence veterans, and they told him to end the program. The NSA never conceded illegality, even as a federal judge said that the almost Orwellian program was unconstitutional. And that has been upheld by a federal appeals court now. Obama agreed in January of 14 to divest NSA of its domestic phone records collection. But, of course, this is a charade because they still have access to those same phone records. They just don't possess them all. And then he goes into, Ackerman goes into the history of the past year or so. When James Sensenbrenner, the Republican who authored the Patriot Act in 2001, advanced the USA Freedom Act, saying that he never intended for this massive surveillance, dragnet surveillance of Americans to be authorized under the law that he claims he wrote. And then intelligence agency lawyers, who didn't like the Freedom Act, allowed it to pass out of committee, and then they came in with blowtorches. And they dismantled the backdoor search ban. All the privacy and transparency restrictions were weakened without any vote. No, the only vote came from the NSA and the FBI. The White House sat still for that. Now, ultimately, the Senate failed to pass that bill at the end of last year. And that's why we were back at it this year. And it was enhanced because of the expiration on at the end of May, on May 31st, of the portions of the Patriot Act we've been describing. So, here's another comment from Spencer Ackerman. Cognizant that the Freedom Act leaves the vast majority of NSA powers untouched, Rand Paul and his allies say they intend to fight for years, particularly through 2017, when the FISA bill that Obama voted for in 2008 will expire. Obama will be gone from office by then, Ackerman writes, but his vacillations over surveillance continue. No sooner had the Freedom Act passed than an administration official confirmed to The Guardian that the NSA would actually restart the bulk surveillance that the bill bans for another 6 months to transition to a system where the telecom companies retain control of the data and provide it to the NSA or FBI based on a court order that doesn't even require the typical probable cause standard. Ed Snowden remains a pariah stranded in Russia, facing jail time for telling Americans about what their government was doing secretly and illegally in their name. Obama has never shown Snowden the slightest regard. But Obama's caveated, cautious, and mutable stances on surveillance have earned him no allies. Despite his endless defenses of the NSA, its veterans demanded greater deference. Civil libertarians now view Obama as a tragic disappointment. Obama's statement did one more thing, concludes Spencer Ackerman. He portrayed himself as a stalwart and consistent champion of surveillance reform. For the past 18 months, I've called for reforms that better safeguard the privacy and civil liberties of the American people while ensuring our national security officials retain tools important to keeping Americans safe. It was a gesture toward history, toward the kind of president Obama might have been. That's a powerful indictment. And if you still have any illusions that Barack Obama is a constitutionalist, that he is a progressive, I feel sorry for you. I have to commend Glenn Greenwald. I find him a difficult person and a guy who can be very prickly. But his writing and his analysis, I think, can be so powerful. And today he published at The Intercept a catalog of commentary over the past few years that all revolves around a statement or a similar statement to it. And he leads with Senator Dianne Feinstein demanding passage of the USA Freedom Act, quote, "I have never seen a time of greater potential danger than right now." After issuing her scary warning, Feinstein claimed, "I've never said that before." And then Greenwald trots out a screenshot of Feinstein from December 2013. Where she says that the terror threat is greater than before, and she's never seen it like this before. Quote, "I think terror is up worldwide. The statistics indicate that." She says, "I think that there's a real displaced aggression in this very fundamentalist jihadist group." And she basically said what all these other people who are cataloged here, Mike Rogers, says the threats have never been greater. Fearmongers in the West, for fearmongers in the West, writes Greenwald, it's always the scariest time ever. So former Deputy CIA Director Mike Morrell, regarding the lone wolf, he said the terrorist threat to the United States has never been greater. David Cameron, UK Prime Minister, the terrorist threat has never been greater. Homeland Security Director in New York State, Jerome Hauer, I think the threat has never been greater. Here's Congressman Mike McCaul in 2014. I've never seen a greater threat in my lifetime. In June 2014, CNN quoting an anonymous EU counterterrorism official, the threat of attacks has never been greater. And the list goes on and on. I won't bore you with it. But Greenwald makes an important point, that these chicken littles have been telling us the sky has been falling and that the threats have never been greater, to the point that we don't believe it anymore. They have cried wolf to the point that we know that at best these are exaggerations. And then Greenwald turns his analytical eyes on an important story that we reported yesterday as it broke. In Boston, 7 o'clock in the morning, FBI and local cops are shadowing a guy, and in front of a CVS drugstore, they claim he pulls a knife, and they had no choice but to shoot him. And in the hours following that, we hear leaks and some official statements from authorities that identify the 26-year-old man as a black Muslim, Usama Abdullah Rahim. And Greenwald does a good job of breaking down the reports that we were told he had a machete and then a military-style black knife. And Greenwald writes, literally within hours of the killing, both the Boston and national media had uncritically published multiple wholly uncorroborated accusations about Rahim based solely on the claims of the law enforcement agencies that had just killed him. Some law enforcement officials were even granted anonymity by these journalists in order to smear their victim. Rahim was almost instantly convicted by the media of being a dangerous terrorist preparing to carry out an ISIS-inspired attack. And, of course, this occurs while the Patriot Act is not yet passed through the Senate. Could this be staged? Could this have been drummed up for political purposes? It's a reasonable question. So then Greenwald discloses the smearing party was started by a local TV reporter, Cheryl Fiandaca, who bills herself as an investigative reporter for Channel 7 in Boston. And she tweeted, Usama Rahim was allegedly radicalized by ISIS, social media, and may have been planning to attack police. Well, Greenwald discloses that prior to joining Channel 7 News last year, Fiendaca was the official spokeswoman for the Boston Police Department, and she's the ex-wife of former Boston Police Commissioner Bill Bratton, who's now the top cop in New York City. Now, in the immediate aftermath of the fatal shootings by her former employers, she's giving anonymity to sources to smear Rahim as radicalized by ISIS social media, whatever that means, and as someone who may have been planning to attack police. We've even heard that he may have been planning to behead a police officer, but all of this comes from either anonymous sources or government officials. And then Greenwald breaks down the bad coverage on NBC News and moves on to say that even the police's version of events, if believed, raises all sorts of questions. They say Rahim was under 24-hour surveillance by the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force, and they were monitoring him for at least 2 years. But when they approached him, they had no arrest or search warrant. Instead, they simply wanted to question him. And Greenwald rightfully asks, you know, if they've been tagging and tailing this guy for 2 years, why didn't they have some paper that they could use if they wanted to take him into custody? So now we hear the other side of the story. Rahim's brother, who is a former Boston area imam, who's known by the Boston Globe as a voice of moderation and compassion, claimed that Rahim was on the phone with his father. His father says that his son complained that he couldn't breathe just before he expired. There are also some claims that he was actually shot in the back, which would make lunging with a knife toward police officers a little problematic, but we're unable to confirm that at this point. So this is another case where we have to be skeptical, and the corporate media does not provide that exercise, that role, as they historically have. And it leaves us to doubt the chicken littles and the boys and girls who cry wolf all too often. Every day I like to pause for a moment to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. And if you're a current subscriber, be sure to check your PayPal account, because occasionally PayPal just unilaterally cancels the subscription payments. And that can cause your subscription to be canceled on my side without your knowledge or intention. So please do keep an eye on that, because I've seen a number of people who have recently, like Anna... Gordonier she recently canceled her subscription so she could restart it because PayPal had intervened there. So my thanks to Carla Mahoney, Andy Krieger, DGL Engraving, and Bill Goodacre. They're all monthly subscribers to this podcast, and I appreciate the support you provide, and I need your help to keep this all going. So come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on the link that says sign up. At the next page, you choose whatever's comfortable for you, $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription, and new annual subscribers earn a bonus gift from me, the ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's latest called Empire of Chaos. Yesterday, we led our news and comment podcast with Jason Leopold's appearance before the House Government and Oversight Committee on any proposed amendments to the Freedom of Information Act law. And Jason is a self-acknowledged geek about FOIA, about public documents. He's been called a FOIA junkie, a FOIA terrorist by some of the people on the receiving end of his requests. And in his statement before the House committee yesterday, he related that one respondent at the Defense Department was so annoyed with Leopold's repeated requests for information and all of the dodges that the Pentagon has to go through to avoid them that he offered him a deal. Look, we'll cough up the documents you're asking for today if you promise never to ask again. Now, that is so far out of bounds as to be laughable. And I have put together a series of highlight clips of Jason's testimony, that most of which will make sense even though it's out of context, And I do want to apologize. I ran into some technical problems when I tried to pull the audio feed off of C-SPAN. For some reason, the only way I could do it was to put a microphone up next to the speaker on my computer. So this audio isn't perfect, but it's intelligible, and you'll be able to hear Jason as he responds to questions. And the voice that tells him he leads an exciting life because of all the FOIA work he does comes from a freshman congressman from here in the Bay Area, a Democrat named Mark DeSaulnier. So here are a series of highlights from Jason Leopold's testimony before the House Oversight Committee yesterday.
Mr. Leopold, have you experienced an increase in agencies' use of exemptions over the last several years?
Indeed, B5 would certainly fall within that overuse of that exemption. I mean, there is, I deal with many agencies, CIA, NSA, Department of Defense. So it's understood that certain information that I'm seeking, certain documents that I'm seeking, that there's going to be other exemptions that are used, exemptions like B1, withholding, there's the national security exemption. Oftentimes, though, it becomes clear when these cases go to court that some of the information that is being withheld to protect the government agencies or the administration from some sort of embarrassment, even the national security exemption. And those exemptions are used across the board at all government agencies. I also just want to make a point here since Mr. Cummings brought it up about what could be done in this bill that you're working on. Please put something in the bill that holds some of these agencies and some of the FOIA requests FOIA officers accountable. There is no penalty at all for routinely violating the law, violating FOIA. So they can do it at will, and they do it, and there is no accountability whatsoever. There's no repercussions at all as a result of that.
Appreciate that.
I routinely check all the government websites' FOIA reading rooms.
I saw that.
They're not regularly updated.
You live an exciting life, Mr. Leopold.
Yeah. thank you. Yes, no, it's quite exciting. Thank you for that. but I do check their reading rooms regularly, and they're just they don't update it. They don't update their reading rooms with documents, which they should. But in terms of electronically, I mean, I file requests electronically. I get responses electronically, and oftentimes I do get records, even though they're heavily redacted, electronically as well. So I think that on that end, it's working to some degree.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
With regard to the Office of Government Information Services, I mean, basically, they have absolutely no power because the Office of Information Policy within the Justice Department that's supposed to ensure that all government agencies are adhering to Attorney General Eric Holder's guidelines, they don't allow them to have any power. They're interfering with that role, of the FOIA ombudsman. So it gets much deeper. I want to also, for the record, state that I have never, ever received a response from any government agency nor a phone call that says, we are experiencing budget constraints, therefore we can't process your request, nor can we give you any records. Never heard that before. So I recognize that budget constraints exist within the federal government, but it has never, ever, I've never heard of it impacting my ability to access records. And one great thing about FOIA is that in addition to filing FOIA requests, you can actually file a request to find out how the specific agency is handling your request. I like to call it the meta FOIA.
Yes.
And I ask for processing notes. Mm-hmm. And within the processing notes, you can see how these agencies are handling the requests. And within the Office of Information Policy, I could tell you that I've obtained documents with regard to one of my requests where the FOIA officers and the attorneys are actually making fun of me. Saying that I should belong to some sort of FOIA posse, and perhaps that should even be my band name, which I think is, may actually be a cool band name. But the point being that, the the FOIA cop is not doing its job and not allowing the FOIA ombudsman to be the FOIA ombudsman.
Thank the gentleman. Now I recognize the gentleman from Ohio.
Thank
Mr.
you, Mr.
Jordan, for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Leopold, has it gotten, I may cover some ground that's already been covered. Has it gotten worse? FOIA requests for information, has it more difficult for you to get the information you requested?
It is. It gets increasingly worse with the passage of years.
And more redactions than you ever used to see?
Yes. I mean, the more I request, the more records I request.
More deliberative process exemptions than you've ever seen before?
There's no question. I mean,
more other exemptions that apply for certain agencies than you've ever seen before?
I definitely would say B7A at FBI is overused.
Is this the first time that you've testified in front of Congress?
It is.
So first time on any issue, and certainly the first time on this issue?
First time on any issue, probably the last time.
Understand. which tells us something on both ends. And Ms. Atkins, what ultimately compelled you all to come here? What's the cause of it all? Mr. Leopold, can you give me an answer to that? Because I got an idea, and I'd be happy to give it, but I'd rather hear what you all say here, at least first.
I came to Congress, or came here today, because I was asked to testify. I think this is a really important issue. I use FOIA aggressively. The public benefits.
No, you misunderstood me. I want to go back to the question, why is the problem getting worse? Why are the redactions so much? Why are the exceptions so much? Process?
I was just answering the last part of your question. Why are they getting worse? I don't know. As I indicated, I file for processing notes, and that gives me insight as to how these agencies handle FOIA requests, what goes on behind the scenes. What I see is an increasing use of exemptions to withhold information that the government may feel to...
Let me go right... I got a minute, sorry. Let me go right to this. I'll stick with you, Mr. Leopold, even though I assume I can... Has it increased under the Obama administration? Has it increased since we got the email, the letter that Mr. Craig, White House counsel, wrote to all the general counsels at the respective agencies in the federal government?
I would say my experience, it has increased. Let me just add, this administration and the last administration is that this administration signed an executive order promising a new era of transparency and open government.
And it's
during the Bush years, I knew I wasn't getting anything.
And I commend Leopold for basically ignoring Congressman Jordan of Ohio, who kept peppering him with questions and interrupting him and getting out his statement about how the Obama White House promised to be more transparent and has been anything but. Well, forgive my language, but the clusterfuck in Syria has just gotten more complicated. News accounts are telling us that there appears to be an unholy alliance between the brutal dictator Bashar al-Assad and his military forces and the forces of the Islamic State, at least as it pertains to the efforts to control an important northeast city called Aleppo. On Tuesday, Islamic State fighters fought rival Syrian insurgents amid fears that the Islamic State was positioning itself to make Aleppo its next big prize. And at the same time, the other rebel groups complained that the United States has refrained from contributing air support to help them fend off simultaneous attacks by the Syrian government and the Islamic State. Now, the charges and countercharges of subterfuge and double dealing underscore the complexity of the battlefield, but also the idiocy of American involvement. Because we claim to be supporting the very groups that are now the targets of both the Syrian government and the Islamic State, the so-called moderates. But those moderates include the al-Nusra Front, which is openly aligned with al-Qaeda, and others with murky connections to the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia. I mean, it's a huge mess. And who wins? If the U.S. in supporting the rebels sees the fall of the Assad government, then the Islamic State takes over. And if, through our underhanded means and covert operations, we're able to somehow engineer the demise of the Islamic State or at least get them out of Syria, then the Assad government stands and we lose. I can't see any way that the U.S. even comes to a draw with military operations in this region. And it's just bizarre. At the same time, our new puppet in Baghdad, Haider al-Abadi, is complaining that the U.S. isn't doing enough. And I believe all of this sets the stage for Obama to reluctantly relent at some point in the near future and commit U.S. troops to a new ground war in Iraq and a new ground war in Syria, and maybe even beyond those borders. I consider this to be extremely dangerous, and the idiocy, that's the best term I can come up with. There's no strategy. There is no overarching concept here of how this turns out. We're fighting because we're fighting. We're fighting because IS beheaded some people and they do gruesome things when they take over a town. It is sheer madness. And we're going to pursue it. President Obama took the opportunity of a television interview on a TV show in Israel called Uvda, which translates to English as fact. And he said that Israel is risking losing credibility because of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's stance on Palestine. And he hinted that the U.S. may no longer use its veto to block resolutions opposed by Israel at the UN. Now, this is an important step forward, and Obama, again, is bobbing and weaving. It was just a week ago or so that he put on a skullcap, a Jewish yarmulke, or kippah, whichever word you prefer, and went to a synagogue in Washington to say that he is the most Jewish president who's ever been in the White House. I mean, I didn't say that. But it parallels what he said. So he was interviewed by the Israeli journalist Ilana Dayon, and he said he didn't see any likelihood of a framework peace agreement while he's still in office. He's giving up. And, you know, these are veiled threats that Obama is using, but I hope he takes the veil off. It would be astounding for the U.S. to refrain from running interference for Israel at the next U.N. vote, whether it's about the West Bank or the aspirations of the Palestinians for statehood, UN membership. There are a lot of things Obama could do. Unfortunately, I think these are just empty threats. Remember diplomacy? You know, before we used drones to summarily execute people and covert operations all over the world to expand our control and influence? Yeah, diplomacy. Well, I'm happy to report that they're attempting it related to the conflict in Yemen. An American official, whose name is Ann W. Patterson, the Obama administration's top diplomat for the Near East, held meetings in Oman last week to discuss the violence in Yemen, and those meetings came just before the release of an American journalist who's been held there named Casey Coombs. Representatives of the Houthis participated in the Oman discussions. They haven't been able to get them to the table elsewhere. And Patterson also traveled to Saudi Arabia as part of a broad engagement with elements of the Yemeni political spectrum, as it's put. So it's unclear how the Saudis will view this. But this story in the New York Times has a telling paragraph I want to quote to you. The Pentagon has been providing intelligence and advice on targets to the Saudi-led coalition in its air campaign against the Houthis in what American and Saudi officials had hoped would be a quick and decisive campaign. It has not worked out that way. Well, kind of like Iraq. It's going to be a cakewalk. It's going to be over in 6 weeks. Don Rumsfeld was already packing to leave. And the idea that the Houthis and that the complicated situation in Yemen could be resolved by aerial bombardment? I think, once again, we have miscalculated. Well, we've got more Democrats running for president, and I say bring them on. because we need alternatives to Hillary Clinton, and I'm not sure who it might be. I love Bernie Sanders and his policies. I'm intrigued by Martin O'Malley. He's got some deficits with Baltimore police issues. And now enter from stage right, Lincoln Chafee. Now, he's a former Republican senator from Rhode Island. Then he switched to independent status and ran for governor, served one term. And now he says he's a Democrat and wants to run for president next year. He's 62 years old, comes from a political family. He became a senator when his dad died, and they appointed him to succeed him, and then he won a term in his own right. And Chafee distinguished himself as the only Republican senator who voted against Bush's invasion of Iraq. And he has some progressive positions that I think are very interesting, and I welcome his entry into the debate. Now, one of the things I'm learning about that while he was the governor of Rhode Island, it says here he received praise for his overall of the state's pension system, his education policy, and he also was ensnared in high-profile controversies, such as a debate about whether Christmas trees should be called holiday trees. That's a high-profile controversy? Bullshit. That's just Fox and the phony war on Christmas. So we'll see how Lincoln Chafee fares. And like I said, I welcome wider entrance into this race. And I am going to say something good about Hillary Clinton and her campaign for president. You may find this rare. But legal operators, including the lawyer who is lead counsel to the Clinton for President campaign, are filing lawsuits in important states like Ohio, Wisconsin, North Carolina, and others, where the state legislatures and Republican governors have significantly rolled back voting rights, and they've created new barriers to participation, mostly by Democratic or likely Democratic voters. And so they're filing lawsuits in Ohio, Wisconsin, North Carolina. Hillary is in Texas, where she's going to give a speech talking about the importance of voting rights. And it's about time Democrats have paid attention to these issues, because the Republicans have been shifting the playing field to sharply limit the potential for Democrats to win. And with the widespread gerrymandering that has turned the House Republican, it's just one example. And we can't rely on honest elections. And we cannot allow these rule changes that limit participation by groups who are likely more left to stand. So, Hillary Clinton, this may be the first and last time I say it, but I fully support this effort by your campaign apparatus. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast you're invited to share with absolutely everyone, and I hope you will. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.